Thank you very much for inviting me back. We had a string of classes in which I think the first one in the series was on medical assistance in dying, and then I was supposed to talk about DNRs and when one can stop treating, and then Marjorie asked me for this month if I could talk about dealing with bereavement and grief.
Come on.
But especially, with Pesach coming, just celebrating Purim, Passover is around the corner. I don't want to be thinking about grief. And I started preparing something completely different about Purim versus Passover, and I actually had it all thought out, and then realized on Shabbat, actually, that the idea that I was working with actually fit in with how one deals with grief and pain. So what you will hopefully come away with is both a what I think is a nice thought that can be shared at your Seder, and also talks about how we deal with pain, emotional pain in Judaism. So you get two for the price of one. Specifically, the line in the Haggadah that I want to talk about is one that is very important from a Jewish law perspective, and affects the way people, and particularly Sfardim, conduct their seder. The line in the Hebrew comes from a Mishnah, an early Talmudic text. I think I actually brought it on your sheet, but not at the beginning. I brought it later on in the sheet, in which we say, source number 10, number 18. The Hebrew is Bechol Dor Vador Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo Kiluhu Yatzami Mitzrayim. In every generation, one must see himself as though he had left Egypt. Right? The line there in number 18. In every generation, one must see himself as though he had left Egypt. And they quote the biblical verse to tell your child, on that day, God acted for me when I left Egypt, as though we had departed from Egypt. That's the standard version of this. However, Sfardim follow an alternate version, which says not Chayav Adam Lirot Et Atzmo. One has to see oneself as though he left Egypt, but rather Laharot Et Atzmo. My Hebrew speakers, right? You have one has to shove as though one had left Egypt. Anyone know what I'm talking about in terms of the Sfardi Seder? Does this sound at all familiar? Any Spartans?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I can tell you whatever I want. No, the difference is that whereas your good rank and file Ashkenazi Jew has a Seder in which we read through the Haggadah and we tell the story and we sing the songs and we discuss what happened, Spartans of various communities have different ways to act it out. So, for example, there are those who will take scallion at the Seder and hit the person next to them on the shoulder, hopefully not hard, to act out the whipping that's going on for slaves in Egypt. They will take a bowl of water, put it down on the floor at one point, and have everybody walk over it as though they're crossing through the sea. People wear costumes, all sorts of ways to act out leaving Egypt. And what I want to talk about, and as we'll see, is the importance of doing that. What is that about? What does that tell us regarding Passover? So that's the line that I'm going to focus on. But in order to get there, it's going to take a while, because that's number 18 for a reason. I want to start out with the following question. What are the differences between Purim and Passover? What are the differences between Purim, which we just celebrated, and Passover, which is coming up next? So, we immediately zero in on the culinary. Not quite Sukkaniyot, though. You jumped to Hanukkah.
Oh, sorry.
Hamantashen, right. Hamantashen and Masa. Major difference, I think. Unless you're Hamantashen and poppy seed, in which case it might as well be Masa. But sorry. You know that Hamantashen is not the original name, right?
Right.
You know that they were originally called Mantashen. Haman may well have had a hat, and for all I know, it had three corners. But no, manpashin, which means
mun,
which is poppy seed, and passion are pockets. Right? It's pastry pockets that hold poppy seeds. The manpashin. But in any case, it's true. Each one has their hallmark foods. Judith.
I think possibly there is no interference or assistance from God in Purim. Salvation, whereas in Passover, there's a very direct.
Right, so Judith points to the story itself. How Purim, even though there's an acknowledgement ritually that God is behind everything that happens, and when you read the story, you say, well, how in the world did that sequence of events play out? Nonetheless, everything is credited to a human cause. All the effects are credited to human causes, whereas Passover, God is everywhere. Whether you're talking about God speaking to Moses, whether you're talking about the plagues, or you're talking about splitting the sea, it's all God-driven. So that's a major difference as well. You can say it.
Same thing.
So that's certainly a difference. There are many more differences. From a ritual perspective, first of all, Passover is biblical and comes with a prohibition against malacha, against various types of work on the holiday. Purim is rabbinic and does not have that level of prohibition. Passover is 7 days, right? Purim is how many days?
Right.
1 plus 1, right? 1 in general, and then a separate day, the second day in Jerusalem, effectively, but it's really walled cities. Yeah.
Can I ask? Because I just came back from Israel, and my friend was very annoyed that she lives in Jerusalem and she had to wait, and they were going to have their suit on Friday.
Yes.
Why is it that it's a day later in these walled cities?
That's a really good question. Why is the walled city different? So to make a long story short. We don't have short stories, but so remember what was supposed to happen. The month is Adar.
Yeah.
The 13th day of Adar is the day when all of our enemies are scheduled to attack us. Right? That's when we were all supposed to die. It was the 13th day of Adar, which was last Wednesday. The decree that Esther and Mordecai prepare, and Ahasuerus stamps, says that we are able to defend ourselves on the 13th day of Adar. And so we go to war in our own defense on the 13th day of Adar around the kingdom. That is in most of the kingdom where things end. The war goes on the 13th, and then on the 14th, we celebrate. So the war is the 13th, and then the 14th is just a one-day thing because, again, keep in mind, the Jews did not fight this war for the sake of gaining territory, for the sake of gaining spoils. The Megillah emphasizes repeatedly that Ahasuerus says, you can do whatever you want, and that the Jews did not take any spoils, and they only fought against those who were their enemies who had come to attack them. I know that there's a modern trend to look at Purim as a very bloodthirsty holiday, but when you actually read the Megillah, you realize this was fundamentally a war of self-defense, and that's precisely why it's only a one-day war almost everywhere. Almost everywhere, this is the sequence. The 13th, they defend themselves, and then the 14th is the holiday. However, Esther makes a request. The capital city, the city of Shushan, Haman's home base, Esther says, there's too much of a threat against us. And so what I want, in Shushan specifically, in the capital, the Persian Empire had 4 capitals, each one for a different season. But in Shushan, this capital, they're going to fight on the 14th day as well. And then on the 15th, they'll stop and they'll have their holiday. So that everywhere but Shushan, they celebrate on the 14th day of Adar. In Shushan, they celebrate the next day, the 15th day of Adar. Now, how does that translate to Jerusalem today? Well, in order to commemorate what happened, the sages of the time said, everybody in general is going to celebrate Purim on the 14th day of Adar. That's when the original celebration was for almost everybody. However, to commemorate what happened in Shushan and that extra day, cities that are like Shushan, that have walls, because being a walled city in the day of Purim meant more than just architecture. Having a wall meant you were an established city. That was the place everyone would gather at a time when they were under attack. That meant your borders were established. It wasn't simply sort of an urban sprawl type of thing, houses here and fields here, but it had a defined structure. It meant you were a city of significance. So all cities of significance like that, walled cities, are going to celebrate on the 15th. Except there was one problem. Because like I said, we don't have short stories. And the problem that we had was that Jerusalem did not have a wall in those days. This is the period after King Cyrus, the Persian king who conquered the Babylonians, had allowed the Jews to come back to Israel and to build a temple. But before, there was a wall around the city. And the city was under constant attack from the Samaritans. They were suffering terribly. If you're reading the beginning of the biblical book of Nehemiah, you read about this there. And because of that, there's a fear. Cities like Shushan in Persia are going to be recognized as real cities, and Jerusalem is not. So the sages said, we're going to grandfather in Jerusalem. Since Jerusalem had a wall originally, we're going to count Jerusalem. So this became, the 15th day of Adar became the celebration for Shushan and walled cities, including Jerusalem with its wall, which goes back to the days of Joshua. And the result of that, paradoxically, is that today we don't have a Jewish community in a walled city of Shushan anymore. Right? We don't have any walled cities we know of from that time where Jews are living today. But Jerusalem still has a wall. It's been rebuilt a couple of times since then. But what it means is that the only place that I know of where anyone celebrates Purim on the 15th day of Adar at this point is Jerusalem. Even though Jerusalem only got grandfathered in, so that it shouldn't be of a lower status than Shushan. So I don't know if that made a lot of sense to people. Hopefully it did. It answered the question. It's the right answer. But that's the story. But going back to where we were. Differences between Purim and Passover. Purim, we read the Megillah. Passover has Hallel, right? Songs of praise. And of course, we have the Haggadah at the Seder. Purim has costumes. Right? Passover, again, if you're Sephardi, you can have costumes at your Seder. There's the kittel, sort of a costume. Well, the pillows, traditionally everyone got a pillow. And the mother being a queen, that's not unique to Passover. That should be daily. So we have differences. There are many differences. The truth of the matter is, Purim involves a threat to our lives. Passover involves a threat to our freedom. Passover leads to the creation of a nation. Purim enables the survival of that nation. What we're going to see is that there's another difference between them in terms of the way we approach grief, the way we approach pain, and that's where we're going with this. So I start out on your sheet with the first source now. A passage from the Talmud speaks about 2 months on the Jewish calendar, the month of Av and the month of Adar. So we already know that Adar is the month that Purim takes place. What is it that Av is most known for? Tisha B'Av, right? The destruction of the first and second temple occur in the month of Av. And so the Talmud here, the first source says, just as when Av enters, when the month of Av begins, we reduce our joy, so when Adar enters, we increase joy. The Hebrew, Mishnechnas Adar, Marbim B'Simcha. We increase our joy. Rav Papa taught the following interesting law. If you were to give me an illustration of what joy looks like, so I would have said, listen to music, right, eat good food, have get-togethers, right? That's what I would have expected joy looks like. That's not the example the Talmud brings. Take a look. Rav Papa said, therefore, since this is a time of joy, a Jew who has litigation with a non-Jew should avoid him in Av when one's mazel is weak. That's a bad time. And make himself available in Adar when his mazel is strong. What in the... That's your illustration of joy? If you got to go to court in Adar because it's a happy time? That's a very strange piece of advice. So we have to come back to that. Obviously, or maybe I should say obviously, what's the reason why Adar would be a time of joy? For Purim, right? We were saved from disaster. We were saved from death. That's the source of our joy. But here I want to ask, what is joy as a concept within Judaism? What is it that makes somebody happy?
Freedom.
Weddings. Sorry? Health. Big one.
Peace.
Family. It's very funny. I would have...
Less reason to worry.
Less reason to worry. So I'm going to come back to that, because that's actually a very important answer. Take a look at source number two. I love this source. This one always... I don't know if it surprises people, but... Well, you'll see. They're talking about the Torah's commandment to rejoice on the holiday, the Samachta Bechagecha. So the Talmud says one is obligated to gladden his children and household for the holiday. As the Torah says, you shall rejoice on your holiday. With what does one gladden them? How do you make people happy? With wine. No one said wine. When I talked about what makes people happy, no one here said wine. Rabbi Yehuda said, men with that which suits them, and women with that which suits them. What suits men is wine. But what about women? What's going to make them glad? Rabbi Yosef taught, in Babylon, color clothes. In Israel, pressed linen clothes. No. So colored and pressed linen depend on the fabric. It's not about the color per se. It's that the colored clothing tends to be made out of a heavier material. And in Babylon, which is a very rainy land, and it was colder, they wanted the heavier material for their new clothing. Whereas in Israel, the linen, lighter material, was more appropriate to the climate. So on the one hand, wine. And on the other hand, new clothing. You know, stereotypes are there for a reason. The idea here is that there is an element of joy that comes from physical pleasure. And if I just stopped with that source, I would assume that when the Talmud speaks about being happy, it's about physical pleasure. That's really what we're talking about. But it can't really be true. And there are a variety of sources in Jewish texts, in the Talmud itself, that show that it's not true. But I thought a really good example was given by Rabbi Avram Price, who I suspect some of you may have known. He was a rabbi in Toronto for decades. So he talked about something very interesting. Somebody who is a mourner, someone who's an avail in Shiva, any restrictions on what that mourner can eat or drink? Nope. Mourner can eat and drink. If the mourner enjoys sushi, the mourner can have sushi. Doesn't make a difference. However, we have a rule that says that during Shiva, a mourner is not allowed to study Torah. Because studying Torah is pleasure. So you're going to tell me studying Torah is pleasure, but sushi isn't? It could be. Maybe that's, look, you know, that more about you. That's, I think that's wonderful. But why is it that studying Torah is going to be prohibited for the mourner, and we don't say, but stay away from foods that people enjoy, stay away from wine, for example. So Rabbi Price makes an important distinction in source number three. He says, it appears in my humble opinion that there are two concepts. One who is enveloped in sorrow and eats, and receives pleasure from eating. And two, one who is hungry, but is happy from the arrival of good news or hearing music and song. The pleasure, the term in Hebrew for the pleasure is oneg. The term for joy is simcha. And what he's saying is the two are not synonymous. Even though we talk about wine and new clothing making somebody happy, fundamentally it's about what's going on in your heart. Pleasure, he says, is not prohibited for a mourner. He may eat and enjoy his eating. He is only prohibited from joy. Therefore, he may not learn Torah while in mourning, because Torah gladdens the heart. So the idea that Rabbi Price is expressing here And again, I think it's a broader idea within Judaism that you could support, and he does, from various sources, is that joy is really about a relaxed mental state. I am not worried, right? There's your answer. I'm not worried, I'm not stressed, everything is fine. Whether I have physical pleasure or not is really separate. You ever hear the idea? It's called in Hebrew the Neshama Yisera. Neshama Yisera. Anyone ever hear that? Anyone ever hear the idea that the food you eat on Shabbat does not contribute to your calories and therefore you're okay? You never heard that?
No.
Oh, yes. It's not true. Sorry. But here's the idea. Here's the idea. The Talmud speaks of a person having neshama yetera, an extra spirit, an extra soul on Shabbat. What does that mean, having an extra soul on Shabbat? So some people take it very literally. Like, I have a soul, and then Friday night, I light candles, an extra soul kicks in. However, that's not the way Rashi, commenting on the Talmud, explained it. Take a look at source number 4. He said it's breath of spirit, harchavat hanefesh, a broadening of one's spirit, for rest and joy. To be open wide, to eat and drink without being repulsed, meaning I don't feel anxiety, I don't feel stress, I can enjoy my meal and feel good about what I'm doing. And that's what's supposed to come with Shabbat, because I say all my work is done, I can't deal with that right now, it's out of my mind, and all I do now is just have a good day. That's what I'm supposed to have on Shabbat. That's this neshama yetera, this extra spirit, a feeling of I have what I want. And that's what we have on Purim. We were under threat, and we survived. Like the Megillah says, v'nahafochu, everything was reversed. And so we have feasts, and so we celebrate. It's a feeling of nothing is going to harm me now. I don't have to worry. And to me, that goes back to source number 1 and Rav Papa's example of what it means to be happy in Hadar. It's not about wine, and it's not about food, and it's not about new clothing. It's simply not feeling anxiety. You have litigation with somebody. Don't do it in Av. That's a time of anxiety. That's a time when we're under threat. You can do it in Adar and feel like everything is going to be okay. That's the month when God wants us to feel it's all going to work out for you. But there's reality. And the reality is that the story of Purim doesn't have a truly happy ending. Anyone here ever notice the last chapter of the Megillah? Sorry, always bother you. Yeah. The last chapter of the Megillah is tiny, it's 3 verses. And, you know, there is no opportunity to grab for Haman anymore, so the kids are really antsy, right? Everyone's looking to get out the door at that stage. And it's too bad, because people miss what happens. Take a look at source number 5. And King Ahash, it's a 3 verse chapter. I only brought you the first 2 verses, because those are the ones that are relevant here. And King Ahasuerus levied a tax upon the land and the islands of the sea. You know, when I read the Megillah, I read it in the synagogue, you pause for Haman to let people make noise for Haman. So every year, at least one time that I read it, I try to pause on that word just to see if anyone's going to grab the word tax. And I pause to see, but no one ever grabs the word. And King Ahasuerus levied a tax upon the land and the islands of the sea, and all of his deeds of strength and might, his, Ahasuerus's, and the explication of the greatness of Mordechai, who was elevated by the king, are recorded in the book of the accounts of days of the kings of Media and Persia. In other words, at the end of this book, Ahasuerus is still the king. He's still in charge. The same one who signed off on Haman's desire to kill the Jews and said, you don't even need to pay for it, I'll pay for it myself. He's still in charge. Where's Esther at the end of the Megillah? Back in the palace/Herod, whatever her position is. But she's back in the palace, cut off from her people, and stuck with this guy as her quasi-husband. The Jews are still living under the Persians in the Persian Empire. The temple, the construction of the temple that Cyrus has permitted, is actually on hold at this point in our history, because the Samaritans had gotten the Persians to halt the construction, and Ahasuerus did not allow us to continue to rebuild it. For all the relief of the story of Purim, we're still not out of the woods. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Talmud asks a question. It wants to know. We sing Hallel in the Haggadah. We sing Hallel in the service each day of Passover. Why don't we sing Hallel in the service on Purim? Hallel is chapters of Psalms that praise God for what He has done for us. So, one answer given here in the Talmud in source number 6, the sage Rava said, he says, it's fine to sing Hallel for Passover, because then we can say, sing, O servants of God, Hallelu Abdei Hashem, one of the lines from the beginning of Hallel. So we became servants of God, not of Pharaoh. But on Purim, sing servants of God and not of Ahasuerus. We're still servants of Ahasuerus. It wasn't over yet. That's the big difference. That's what makes Purim different. Let's go back to our question then of how a Jew deals with grief and how a Jew deals with pain. The Purim model is frankly what we're used to seeing in the course of our lives. Not a rescue from all problems, but relief from immediate threats. We know that in the course of our lives and the issues we have to deal with, whether you're talking about health, whether you're talking about money, whether you're talking about anything that comes up in life, there could be something else right around the corner. And what we satisfy ourselves with is relief from the immediate threat. We count the blessings that we have. That's the Purim model. It's a coping model, fundamentally. That's one way to look at grief and pain, and that's the Purim model. We say, you know what, we're going to bang for Haman, we're going to make a big feast, we're going to celebrate, we won this time, and we survived, and let's see what happens tomorrow. Yeah?
Yeah, Ahasuerus gave us a present to make him happy. Now, you look in the history, not at the captain gave us permission to make him happy, and so we were free. We felt freedom in the...
For one day.
I don't think that it was from one day because we said that the whole story is like a fairy tale.
And therefore?
Therefore, we don't know how many days. All the numbers are really making, like Ahasuerus was a king of 127 countries. It also, everything, how many days he made in each day?
180 days.
Okay.
For a reason, though.
What?
For a reason. Because who's invited to that 180 day party?
Yes, but
no,
was
it
was really 180 days?
Keep in mind, Ahasuerus is a 180-day party. People get so fixated on this number. He invited the leadership of all of the lands under his control. You think you can get them all to show up on the same week and they're all just going to be in your headquarters?
I
can believe in the concept of it. I can believe in the concept of a non-literal reader, a number, and saying that a number in a particular case is an exaggeration. But here, it fits the storyline very well, because there was one day when they were attacked, right? That was the day of the decree. I have no reason to think... Because that was the day they were under assault. That was it. So we can talk about it more after, but that's the Purim model. The Purim model fundamentally is... You got your relief. Now let's talk Passover, because Passover is different. Take a look, please, at source number 7. This comes from a text called the Response of the Gaonim, Shuvot HaGaonim. The Gaonim were the leaders of the Jewish people, both from a scholastic perspective and from a quasi-political perspective, from, call it, end of the 6th century, beginning of the 7th century, until basically the beginning of the 11th century. They were based, for the most part, in what is today Iraq. There were other schools at one point in North Africa, in Israel as well. But the Gaon, literally Gaon means person of power. Today it's come to mean genius, because the Gaonim were the heads of the schools, and therefore they were known for that as well. But fundamentally Gaon, like the word Gaava, is somebody with a position of power. So the Gaon in this case was asked about a prayer called Tachanun. What's Tachanun? Pleading, literally. So it's a daily prayer. It's not said on Shabbat. It's not said on holidays. It's routinely said during the week, in mornings and afternoons. after the Amidah. And what happens in Tachanun is one actually sits down and puts one arm up in front of one's face, like one is expressing embarrassment, or if you're really tired, it can be like, you know, I'm exhausted. And says to God, I apologize, essentially, it's a series of verses, but I apologize for what I have done wrong, I regret the mistakes that I have made, God, please forgive me. That's more or less what the prayer of Tachanun is. There's a part that's done like this, then there's a part that's done just sitting, and then there's a part that's done standing up, which reflects when Moses asked for forgiveness for the Jews after the golden calf, he describes himself in those three positions as he pleads with God for the survival of the Jews. The point, though, is that Tachanun, this prayer, is skipped in the month of Nisan, which is the month when Passover takes place. And that's what you see explained here in source number 7. Falling on one's face is always a time of pain. It's painful to do that, to apologize like that and to express that kind of regret. As in, he quotes a few different biblical verses that speak of people falling on their faces. And how those were times of pain. And then he continues to say, and so falling on one's face is always a time of pain, and the days of Nisan and Tishrei are times of joy. What's in Tishrei? Right, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. These are days of joy. Yes, Yom Kippur is a day of joy. It's not the discussion right now. But it is. Yom Kippur is a happy day. We have to get around to that one. But because Tishrei is a time of joy, starting with Yom Kippur till the end of the month, we don't say Tachanun. And because Nisan has Passover in it, as well as one other celebration which is beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss now, and that is the dedication of the Mishkan. When the Jews traveled in the wilderness, they had this traveling temple with them that was dedicated in the month of Nisan. Because of that, we don't say Tachanun in the month of Nisan. That's really interesting. It's a time of joy, and therefore you don't say Tachanun. What I'm confused about, I'm going to erase the Shushan verb explanation now. What I'm confused about is this. I have 2 months that I'm looking at. Adar and Nisan. I say Tachanun in Adar. I did it this morning. In Nisan, I will not say Tachanun. And what I'm confused about is that the month that is identified as a month of joy is Adar. So why am I saying Tachanun in Adar? And why don't I call Nisan a month of joy? It seems like we picked the wrong month. Right? We should have skipped Tachanun in Adar, not skip it in Nisan. The whole thing doesn't fit. It's a very odd phenomenon. It can't really be about joy. And the answer is it's not. The reason to skip Tachanun is not really about joy. It's about a different word. And the word that we're going to talk about is Ge'ulah. Ge'ulah. What does Ge'ulah mean? Redemption. This is a more important word than joy, as we're going to see. Take a look, please, on your sheet, source number 8. A discussion of certain events in our history and when they took place. Rabbi Yehoshua said, in Nisan the world was created. Not the view that it was created around when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah. He thinks the world was created in Nisan. So there. In Nisan the patriarchs were born, meaning, well, leave that date for now. In Nisan, the patriarchs died. On Passover, Isaac was born. On Rosh Hashanah, the slavery halted for our ancestors in Egypt. And in Nisan, they were redeemed. We had our Ge'ulah in the month of Nisan. And what I want to show you is that Ge'ulah is much more powerful than Simcha. Redemption is much more powerful than joy. And that's, to me, the key Purim Passover distinction, is this distinction between joy and redemption. So in order to do this, I needed to know, what does Geulah really mean? Because the word redemption can mean points on your credit card, right? you redeem your miles, right? What in the world is redemption? When you think about it, I can't come up with an easy, simple definition of redemption. Can you? Sorry? Save from pharaohs. Or save from disappearing if the miles expire. Yeah?
It's surviving. It's almost like a rebirth if you're not...
Survival, and then Judah says rebirth, which is, I think, more potent than survival. Right? Survival feels like a part of the thing. Yeah?
Ga'al in Hebrew, you can understand it better than in English.
Yes.
Because Ga'al, it means he saved you from something.
Good. Ga'al is fascinating. It's a very flexible word in Hebrew, and that's where we're going with this. I wanted to know what in the world, Ga'al, Geulah, really means. Sorry?
To save.
Right, to save. But I went looking in other Semitic languages, some of the other ancient Near Eastern languages, Akkadian languages like that, to see. And I came up with something that I thought was very interesting. It doesn't exist in the other languages. Meaning, many words that you will find in Hebrew appear with similar meanings in other ancient Semitic languages. You can find it in Arabic, you can find it in Akkadian, you can find Ugaritic. You can find words that are similar, not this root. It's not my discovery. Other writers have noted this before. But but that in of itself I found interesting, and then I started looking at the way this word is used biblically, and what this word Ga'al Geulah actually means, and I found, unfortunately, that it's used in a pretty broad range of cases. Let's take a look at some of the uses. I gave them to you on the sheet. I gave you examples of each one on the sheet. Take a look at source number 9, please. The very first appearance of this root biblically is a sentence which some of you may know as a bedtime song. For kids. Hamalach HaGoel Loti. Anyone know that song? Well, there are different versions of it. Some people sing it to Bach. But it's Jacob speaking about the angel who was Goel, as I wrote here on the sheet, from all harm. In other words, the image there of Geulah, the earliest use, is to be saved from harm. That's our first appearance. To be Goel is to save from harm. That one's easy. That fits with everything we've said about redemption. And if I could just stop with that usage, it would be dishonest, but it would fit the theme, and that would be that. There's more to it. The second example that I brought here is when the Jews are in Egypt and God pledges to take them out. And I will be goel you, with an outstretched arm and great judgments. There, it's not about being saved from harm. It's being saved from bondage. Still saved from, but oppression, bondage, a claim that another person has over you to demand something of you. So God is going to save us from being bound to somebody else. Then you get a third one. And all of the lands of your holdings, you shall give Geulah to the land. What is that talking about? Nope, close. It is close.
Does it have to do with the space where the land is not worked? That the land is not worked?
Close. It's referring to the Yovel year, the Jubilee year. And under the laws of the Jubilee year, every 50 years, if I bought somebody else's land, their ancestral land, it goes back to them. That is the Geulah that I give the land back. The land is liberated from my control and goes back to the original person with whom it was associated, the original family. That's also called Gikula. So liberate land is also under this.
Rabbi, is
yes.
That upheld by the courts?
Rabbinical courts would. In Israel today, no, because ancestral land requires the division among the tribes and everything else, which we don't currently have. The Jubilee year doesn't exist as of this time. I'm going to give you another example. And if one shall be Goel, his tithe. One of the rules, which I'm going to be brief in explaining because I don't want to get too far afield here into details, but one of the tithes that one separates in Israel is called Maser Sheni. I separate 10% of my produce in certain years and I bring it to Jerusalem to eat there. But that can be really difficult. Because what if I'm a farmer and I have a ton of produce? I have to, I live 2 hours, 3 hours away from Jerusalem. I have to lug 10% of my produce to Jerusalem. So there's another procedure. I can redeem it for cash and take the cash to Jerusalem and use it to buy food there. It's a lot more portable. But that's a basic rule of a tithe, and redeeming the tithe, as I wrote here on the sheets in the fourth line of number 9, and if one shall be goel his tithe. So that's like Miles' example then, right? You redeem produce for cash. And that has the same word in Hebrew, gizula. Gizula now means the angel saving from harm, God saving us from bondage, liberating land, and redeeming produce. But no, we are not done. Because gizula also refers to something called a goel hadam. It's a much darker concept. What's a goel hadam? Literally, redeemer of the blood. Sort of. Goel hadam is essentially a guardian, but for a very dark purpose. In the event that somebody is murdered, the goel hadam, who is a relative, nearest kin basically, is charged with carrying out justice, where the courts don't have the murderer. The goel hadam is able to execute the murderer himself. Now, there are a lot of rules surrounding this. This is not carte blanche to go out and kill people. This is really a longer discussion. The only reason I'm bringing it here is because now I have to add that to my list of places where goel is used. Apparently, it's also the blood relative is the goel hadam. I need a common denominator for all of these uses of the word goel. What in the world is gilula? Oh, and there's one more that I have on your sheet. The speaker in that line, the last line in number 9, is a man by the name of Boaz. He's talking to Ruth. Remember that Ruth is a widow. She is impoverished, as is Naomi, the former mother-in-law. However, Boaz is a relative. And Boaz describes himself as a goel for her. And indeed, he marries her. In order to take her in and make her part of his family and give her protection, he is also blood relative. He's a goel who is going to be her guardian. I'm going to put guardian in here because it's more complicated because it comes with being a relative in this case. But the point now is, all of these fit with the word goel. What is a goel? So far, I would say, a protector of some kind is what I would have said. But then it gets marginally more complicated. And that's when you look historically, a little bit further in time, further ahead in time. And once we've done this, then we'll be able to understand everything a lot better, I hope. There's a strange use of goel that shows up toward the end of Tanakh. The book of Daniel, chapter 1. Daniel and his friends are taken as trophies by the Babylonians. Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar destroys the temple, exiles the Jews, and takes trophies, young Jewish men, and has them stand on display in his court. He wants them fed table scraps. from his own meals. Daniel refuses to eat, even knowing that he could lose his life for his refusal. He explains his refusal. Take a look at source number 10. And Daniel put into his heart not to be Gaal, the Lelti Yit Gaal, with the Patibaga of the king. Patibaga are the scraps off the king's table. He says, that would be Goel to me. What in the world is he talking about? I don't know. That would guard me? That would redeem me? Will protect me? In what way? What is it that he is saying here? It sounds like he's saying, I don't want to be contaminated by it. Take a look at the other line I brought you in source number 10, a criticism of the prophet Malachi in the beginning of the Second Temple, where the Jews are criticized for bringing bad offerings in the temple. They bring their rejects as their gifts to God. You serve upon my altar, let them in Migo'al, bread that is Migo'al. Migo'al with an aleph, not with an ayin, not magil, different word. But the bread that is Migo'al is something that is repellent. And so I'm looking at this, and I can't understand. We have all these nice uses for Gula, saving from harm, saving from bondage, liberating land, redeeming produce, blood relative who's going to take care of somebody, a guardian, someone who saves others. Gula is to be saved from harm, except when it means something disgusting, something repellent. How in the world do you make sense of this? There's actually one more usage biblically that I found, but I'm not going to belabor the point. But there's a use in the book of Ezra as well. And then, I found something fascinating in the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls is called the Temple Scroll. And it describes laws of purity and impurity. And if you take a look at source number 11 from the Yigal Yadin edition of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of the Temple Scroll, and on the day, he's describing impurity, on the day they will remove the corpse from wherever it's been, they will sweep the house from all tig olet of oil and wine. Tig olet, something that has also been made impure. There's a sense that goel can refer to something impure also. So what is it all about? I'll tell you what I think. There is a verse which I brought you in source number 12, but I'm not going to do it from the verse itself. But this is the last complicated part, and then I think it all becomes more clear. There's a word in Hebrew that's used for something that is filthy. It's filthy. It's used for dirt. It can be used, not to be impolite, but it can be used for excrement. The word is so'ah. Sadi vav aleph hei, so'ah. Something which has been produced, or something which is to be removed. Something that you want out of the space where it currently is located. In other words, all of these uses for Yulah, including the negative ones, refer to something which is to be removed from the place where it is. Yulah means removal from my terrible situation in a full and complete removal. Whether that means the angel who saves from harm, whether it means God taking the Jews out of Egypt and saving them from bondage, whether it means liberating the land so it can go back to the original family, whether that means redeeming the produce, the blood relative, the guardian marrying Ruth, all of those cases, as well as the negative examples for Daniel, something which is to be removed, something that is impure, is fundamentally what Gula means. Is to be removed completely and totally from your situation. Take a look at source number 13, which is where God speaks to the Jews about what he is going to do for them. And I will take you out from beneath the suffering of Egypt. I will save you from their labor. You can ignore the underlines for now. I will save you from their labor. I will redeem you from them with an outstretched arm and great judgments. I will take you to me as a nation, and I will be your God. You will know that I am Hashem, your God, who took you out from beneath the suffering of Egypt, and I will bring you to the land. That Gula is what God is promising dramatically. And now, take a look at number 14. That's the four cups at the Seder. What is the source for the four cups? Why do we have four cups of wine or grape juice at the Seder? Exactly. Rabbi Yochanan quoted Rabbi Benaya, the four expressions of redemption. That's what I underlined for you in number 13. I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and I will take you to me as a nation. The fifth one, I will bring you to the land, is the source for the fifth cup, right? Which people call the cup of Eliyahu, the cup of Elijah. That's what that's for. There are other origins for the four cups, but I don't want to distract. The point here is, it's all about being taken out in such a way that we will no longer be slaves of Ahasuerus. On Purim, Ahasuerus is still there at the end. He's still levying taxes. Esther is still trapped. The Jews are still stuck. Pesach, Passover, it's all over. Take a look, please, at source number 15, and you'll see a great example of this. Maimonides writes in his Code of Law, one may dwell anywhere in the world, a Jew can live wherever he wants, other than Egypt. What do you mean? Three times the Torah warns not to return to Egypt. Biblical verse, Deuteronomy, never again shall you return by this path. Another one, you will never again see her, meaning Egypt. And you shall not see them again ever. You will never see Egypt again. God tells us that three times after we leave Egypt to say, this is not just joy. This is not only the simcha of Adar. This is Geulah. You are taken out of where you were, and you will never, ever experience that again. And in fact, we are warned not to seek Egypt again. Take a look at source number 16. I brought you a passage from Jeremiah where he criticizes the Jews of his day. There's a major war going on between the Babylonians off the east and the Egyptians south-southwest. The Babylonians are coming through. God says, you're going to be exiled to Babylon. Some of the Jews say, we're not interested in Babylon. We're going to look for an alliance with the Egyptians. Look at the warning they get. Jeremiah says in number 16, this is the JBS translation. I did the translations on all the others, but I got tired. So he says, but if you say, we will not stay in this land, thus disobey the Lord your God. If you say, no, we will go to the land of Egypt, so that we may not see war or hear the sound of a horn, and so that we may not hunger for bread, there we will stay. If that's what you're going to say, then hear the word of the Lord, O remnant of Judah. Thus said the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, if you turn your faces toward Egypt, and you go and sojourn there, the sword that you fear shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine you weary over shall follow at your heels in Egypt too, and there you shall die. He says, don't you dare go looking for support from the Egyptians. As far as God is concerned, the next time the Jews will have an alliance with Egypt is in a messianic time when Egypt themselves come to recognize God. Take a look at source number 17. I'm rushing a little bit. In Isaiah, where he predicts, on that day, his future messianic time, Israel will be a triad with Egypt and Assyria, blessing in the midst of the land, as God has blessed it, saying, blessed is my nation, Egypt, the work of my hand, Assyria, my portion, Israel. When everybody is united in recognizing God, that's when you're going to see Egypt again.
Okay.
But until then, you're not going to have anything to fear from them. You're fully redeemed. I recognize this raises certain questions about the role of Egypt in our history, but that's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about right now. The point here is that that's why you don't say Tachanun in Nisan. Because you don't say this prayer of Tachanun, this sad prayer, because this is a month when you're fully redeemed. Not like Purim. Purim's approach is realistic. Purim's approach says, I'm never really going to get out from under this, but I can live with it. I'm okay with the way things are. Pesach's approach is supernatural. There is a goel. I can envision an end, a time when my pain will be removed. From a mental health perspective, we encourage people to come to acceptance, right? Four stages of grief. We want people to come to acceptance and to say, I can live with my new reality, with who I am now. And that's the Purim model, and it's reasonable. But in many situations, one can envision a day when the threat will actually be entirely vanished. And that takes me back to what we do with the Seder. Go back to number 18 now, please. In every generation one must see himself as though he had left Egypt. In every generation we have to see ourselves as though we had left Egypt. Meaning, it's important for us to have that aspiration. It's important for us to say, not only I can deal with it, escape from it. I can be above it. And that's what we're doing at our Seder. Whether like the Sephardim, where we'll dress up and act it out and, you know, walk around the table and the whole bit. I think it's just convenient as a model for a whip. I don't think it's anything else. Yeah, I think. I don't know. Maybe it induces tears. I don't know. I'm Ashkenazi also. Sorry. But this is what we're doing, is we're saying we need to see this as a possibility. To look not only for simcha, for joy, but also for geula, to be taken out of where we have been. That's what we're trying to do. This is your Seder Dvar Torah. When you get up to this point in the Seder, you stop everybody, you spend an hour explaining Purim versus Passover, or you just say, there's this thing called joy, there's this thing called redemption, and end of Purim, end of Passover, check. Yes?
Jews are not supposed to live in
Egypt? So it's a very interesting thing. Go back for a second to the top line in number 15 where I gave you the bio, a little blurb there for I, Moses Maimonides. You see what I wrote? 12th century Egypt. Maimonides lived in Egypt. He lived in Egypt, yes indeed. There's even a legend, although it's not true, but there's a legend that he used to sign his letters saying, Moses the small. However, he signed his letters, Moses, son of Maimon, who violates three prohibitions on a daily basis. These verses here. It's not true. But indeed, there's a lot of discussion about how he justified the fact that he indeed lived in Egypt. Is it really a prohibition? Is it not really a prohibition? It's also very interesting because there are Jews now who go on Passover programs and they celebrate in Egypt. I find that bizarre, but it's true. Passover program in Egypt. Go figure. It's sort of like a Greek celebration of Hanukkah. In any case, I have an Iranian neighbor, and I wanted to tell him about Purim, and they decided it wasn't worth it. That's not a joke. That was actually serious. But in terms of these two approaches, I brought you a midrash in source number 19. And the midrash speaks about a few people who, in its words, saw new worlds. Rabbi Levi said, anyone regarding whom the text says in the Torah he was, saw a new world. And Rabbi Shmuel said there are five people like that. Noah, Joseph, Moses, Job, and Mordecai. And I singled out Moses and Mordecai because they're the ones who are relevant for us. Moses, yesterday he fled from Pharaoh. And now he sank Pharaoh in the sea. But Ra'a Olam Chadash, he saw a new world. And Mordecai, yesterday he was designated for hanging. Now he hanged those who would have hanged him. But he saw a new world. The truth of the matter is their new worlds are different. Mordecai still lives under Ahasuerus. Moshe, Moses, lives in a truly new world. And the key for us, I think, is to be able to deal with grief and to be able to deal with pain in the Purim way and to say, I can cope. I can live with this. This isn't as bad as it was. I will not be destroyed by it. But to always keep our eye on Geula, to keep our eye on redemption. And so I brought you in number 20, the concluding line of the passage from the Talmud I brought you before. I brought you in source number 8, Rabbi Yoshua's statement about all the things that happened in Nisan. The patriarchs were born, the patriarchs died, Isaac was born, and in Nisan they were redeemed. B'Nisan nigalu. But the end of the line is what you see in number 20. U'B'Nisan atidin li'gael. In Nisan we will be redeemed in the future. That's why it's such a month of celebration, because of that hope that not only will we have this sort of temporary reprieve, but that we will actually have full redemption. Thank you very much.